Next case is Tamara Ross versus Town of Austin.
Yes.
Mr. King.
Yes, good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. We're here today on an appeal from a summary judgment of a 1983 claim involving a substantive due process claim on behalf of the estate of Kenny Ross and his widow, Tamara Ross. This occurred when the Town of Austin, by failing to properly train its officers, placed Kenny Ross in a position of greater danger or enhanced the danger that he would encounter on that day, which led to his death. The underlying constitutional right here that we look to, as Monfils teaches us, is not the constitutional right of protection per se, but rather the right of Kenny Ross not to be placed in harm's way, a greater harm's way, or an enhanced danger at the hands of a state actor. And how did this occur? Well, it occurred when Captain Noble, who is a member of the Austin Police Department that day, in responding to a known call, a 911 call, that a fellow had tried to kill his wife at a middle school and their children, then having a wreck in the middle section, the intersection of this town. When he first came upon this fellow, he had a gun and was essentially walking down the street. And the affirmative act, and when we look at affirmative act and define it, as this court has previously, as the willful deviation of the status quo, the affirmative act that Captain Noble took without training was that he positioned himself between a store known as the Huck store and the shooter, thereby somewhat arbitrarily deciding who would live and who would die that day. Because by placing himself in that position, Captain Noble then channeled or redirected the shooter, who, by Captain Noble's own admission, had he not done so, was heading toward the Huck store. And in fact, that's in Captain Noble's deposition. It's in the record. In fact, it's in the statement of facts of the appellee at page 2, that had Noble not placed himself where he did and intervened as he did without training, the shooter was on his way to the Huck store and not the liquor store where Kenny Ross was. So
he killed somebody in the other store. So what's the difference?
Well, the point is, Kenny Ross had a right, a constitutional right, not to be placed in a greater harm than he would have otherwise encountered that day. And by the defendant, or the town's own admission, had the officer, who had no training in combat tactical weapon use, had no training in weapon selection, had no training in hostage negotiation, literally had no training in the tactical use of firearms, had that officer not intervened, this shooter was on his way to Huck's and not the liquor store. And had he not gone, beg your pardon?
Who was in Huck's?
Huck's were other folks. There were customers in Huck's. There's no doubt there were people in Huck's. But the point of the argument is the law, the Constitution says, Kenny Ross should not be sacrificed or should not be put in a position of increased danger as a result of the failure of this officer in his training to do what he should have done.
Well, you're saying he should have let him go where he wanted to go, and that was apparently going to Huck's.
No, Judge, that's not it at all. What should have happened is this officer, properly trained, had three opportunities to do what he should have done, which was to engage this shooter prior to his getting to the store.
You mean
the
shooter?
Beg your pardon?
You mean the shooter?
Absolutely.
Oh,
and
what?
He knew. And he knew.
Don't equivocate. Don't say engage. Shooter.
Well, shooting.
You want to kill
him. Because as the record shows, that short appendix...
I understand what you're saying.
Okay.
What you're suggesting then is if a police officer fails to shoot somebody who looks like it's a medicine, if it, he is it's a dereliction of his duty and he's putting other people in violation of their constitutional rights.
So, Judge, what I'm suggesting is when a town who arms an officer...
No. If an officer, trained or untrained, has failed to shoot somebody who looks like a menace, he has now put somebody else in a position where they are unconstitutionally deprived of their safety. Am I correct?
Under these facts, when this officer knows that this particular individual had tried to kill his wife and children at a middle school drop-off at 8 o'clock in the morning.
Do we frame it that way, or do we just say whenever you find somebody that constitutes a menace that looks like they may kill somebody, it is your required constitutional duty to shoot them and kill them?
No. You reframe it in this way, as City of Canton versus Harris told us in the Supreme Court. When you, as a town or an entity, arm an officer, you must provide the training in terms of the proper...
Well, would that training be, and this is my question, would that training include the requirement that he shoot somebody when he looks, the person to whom he is directing his attention looks like he's a menace and might kill somebody else.
No, what the training would require, consistent with Tennessee versus Garner, is that when the subject is an armed fleeing felon, you use the force that is necessary to protect the public.
To kill them.
Well, you may disarm them.
The point is, it's not the Lone Ranger we're talking about.
No.
It's an officer who's faced a situation where he has to make an immediate decision. Is he going to kill him, or is he going to be able to drag it out a little bit and see if he can get him without killing him?
No, this situation factually is an officer who is placed in a position to fail because the town failed to train him in the use of combat tactics of weapons, proper weapon selection. I mean, that's exactly what this case is about. It is not that the officer failed. It is that the town failed to put him in the position to do what constitutionally was required, and that is...
Then what you want us to do is frame a rule saying each town must put all of its officers through combat training and negotiation training so that they will be prepared to meet a situation like this.
Yes, that is...
That's the rule we have to come to.
Yes, because these are known and conscious...
At least I understand your position.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I have a few minutes left for rebuttal, and I'd like to reserve.
Okay, fine. Mr. Horn.
May it please the court, I'm Kirk Horn. I'm here for the Appalachian defendants, Town of Austin. Incidentally, the officer... who is part of our department was not sued in this action. The appellant decided to sue just the department directly, which in my opinion sort of puts the cart before the horse, because as we've touched on already, we got to find out if there's an underlying constitutional violation. Having said that, I'll fall into the trap that they've already set, which is, let's talk about the failure to train. Let's assume there is a constitutional violation. The failure to train, the standard on that is deliberate indifference, which under the Salazar case means the municipality must act intentionally or with criminal recklessness, which isn't the case here. We've got the Tapia case that says if the department is complying with Indiana law, the minimum standard requirements of training, which is 16 hours, I think, then almost as a rule, there's no way there can be any failure to train claim on that basis. And that was the case here. Officer Noble, who's not a defendant, again, exceeded the training every year and continues to do that. Returning to the cart, or the horse, actually, that's what I'm talking about, was there an underlying constitutional violation? The case directly on point here is DeShaney. An officer basically has no duty to enforce the law. He could have not responded to the call. He could have waited at the Dairy Queen, where he was writing a traffic ticket to somebody, and not even gone to the scene. And we know under the law that there would have been no liability, no constitutional violation in that regard. He had the option of doing that. Instead, he decided to enforce the law, or try to enforce the law, and return to a scene that was utter pandemonium in the eyes of the witness, and responded as best as he could. There were 12 to 15 students. Small children and a school bus at this Huck's place, which is a gas station. There were probably 20 other people there getting gas.
There were students in the school bus?
They were outside the school bus, and they were around the Huck's area, right at the entrance of the gas station.
I looked at these pictures from the... I couldn't tell what the heck was going on. I don't know. Maybe, I guess you had to be there.
Yeah, it was utter pandemonium, and it was one officer that was...
But there were kids around.
Yes, and that's in the record, and that's in an affidavit as well. This is an unusual case in that an officer is being sued for not pulling the trigger, for not shooting somebody. Tennessee Garner...
As your opponent points out, the officer is not being sued. The city is being sued for failure to train him to pull the rope. But as near as I understand, if we were to frame a rule that is suggested, we'd have to say that the officer must be taught to shoot and that he must shoot to kill.
That seems to be what they're alleging here.
It is practically impossible to shoot, use deadly force, without the probability of killing. And I said only the Lone Ranger can shoot a gun out of your hand, as near as I can tell.
That's true. And this guy had a minute to respond and try to save as many people as he could, and
he made a decision.
The appellant was in the wrong place at the wrong time. He was in the liquor store.
Tell me, I get a distinct impression, although I don't know that the record shows it, that the body of the decedent was in another room other than that where the shooting occurred.
That's right.
And the shooter, the bad man in the whole crowd, was on the telephone at the time when the shooting occurred?
That's right. The video shows the assailant, the killer, walking in the door, going to the back room where the decedent was. The decedent had gone there earlier to sweep or something like that. The assailant goes back there into this dark room and comes out, and you never see the decedent come out again. Then the guy proceeds to talk on the phone. Our people, dispatch, called him three times to engage him, and you can see him on the video camera.
Does the record disclose any estimate of whether or not the shooting of the decedent occurred long before the phone call or sometime before the phone call?
Yes, I think the undisputed evidence shows that he was murdered immediately upon entering the liquor store. The certificate of death is 8:03, which is the same time the fellow walked into the store on the video camera, and there's no evidence
for that. Close.
Pardon?
They couldn't. I mean, yeah. That may be what they put down, but whether it's 8:03 or 8:05,
there's no evidence to dispute that this fellow was killed after the assailant was put in touch with his wife, and that's the other issue. We've got sort of an analogy to a high-speed chase. I guess it's on foot, but I'm thinking about the cases that we have in our circuit now as well as the U.S. Supreme Court. We've got a high-speed chase, this time on foot, and then we've got this other issue of a hostage situation, and there's no constitutional right either way. Under Tennessee versus Gardner, obviously, the assailant had a right. If my guy didn't feel a duty to feel a need to use deadly force and used it in that situation, we'd be here on that, and I can understand that. But a third party cannot insist that a police officer use force on his behalf. And obviously, since there's no
what's the population of Austin? Just
about 4,000. And there is
the size of the police department. Does the record show that?
I think it does. I think it's in my officer's deposition. It increases every year, and it was probably 10 or 11 at the time.
How old is the town?
Pardon?
How old is the town?
It's in southern Indiana, pretty close to the Ohio River.
Yeah, but sir, how long has the town been in existence?
I don't know that. I don't know when it was incorporated.
Well, as far as I can tell, if it increases every year, it'd have to be 10 years.
I didn't say what that was a consistent rate. There may have been two new people in it from last year, but the police department does increase. Anyway, I won't get into the DeShaney exceptions because the only issue here is, one, was there a constitutional right? There wasn't, as I've touched on. Number two, even if there was a constitutional right, there's a case directly on point asserting what the standard is, which is Lewis versus County of Sacramento, which basically says under this circumstance, you have to show that the officer's actions shock the conscience. And we've got a case in this circuit, Schaefer versus Marathon County, where the officer not only pulled the trigger, but he ended up shooting the hostage. And when there was evidence, when there was no evidence establishing that the officer intended to kill this hostage, that it was an honest mistake, that it was a heated situation, he really tried to kill the assailant but ended up shooting the hostage, they said, this does not shock the conscience. And if we've got that case saying where our guy pulls the trigger and ends up shooting the hostage, if that doesn't shock the conscience, then I can't imagine under any perversion of these facts that it would lie here. If you don't have any more questions,
okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. King.
Thank you, Your Honor. What is shocking to the conscience is, and so the focus is correct, is that this town failed to have any training policy, any training at all in combat use of the arm. That's what's shocking, and that is the deliberate indifference. And this court has said that deliberate indifference is the conscious disregard of the known risk. It's not an intentional criminal recklessness in a 14th Amendment case. This is not an 8th Amendment case. This is the conscious disregard of the known risk. Now, the issue of whether or not state law and minimum training provides some sort of free pass constitutionally just does not flow. This court has never determined that a state minimum standard is the constitutional standard. State law does not define the constitutional standard. For example, we found that some of the training in the 16 hours that Captain Noble had was in grant writing. Completely inept and completely inappropriate for what they knew he would have to face.
Is there anything in the record that if he had been exposed to, what is it, combat training and selection of weapons, what he would have learned to do in this situation?
Yes, if you look at the record, I think it's at Appendix 3, page 626, the affidavit of Charles Braun. Mr. Braun is referenced as an attorney in a footnote in the appellee's brief, but he's in fact an attorney as well as a full-time instructor for the Indiana Law Enforcement Academy in Plainfield in Indiana, and he goes through and talks about exactly what the ongoing training requirements are for an officer that a town knows. Let's not get confused. It's not a fluid situation, as Sacramento, Lewis versus County Sacramento says. It's not a fluid situation for the town policymakers. They knew long before February 28, 2000, that they were not going to train their officers. In fact, the chief, who was supposed to go through training himself per statute and didn't, determined and stated to us that his philosophy on training is the officers best learn it on the street. That was the training policy, the training philosophy, and the policy of this town. That is shocking. We cannot sanction that as a constitutional requirement to allow towns to say, well, we'll just let these people learn on the street and let the chips fall where they may, because doing that sacrifices the constitutional rights of its citizens. Again, I go back to Canton. The Supreme Court said it very clearly. If you are going to arm an officer with a gun, knowing his task is to deal with fleeing felons, you must train him on the use of that weapon and the limitations of the use of the weapon, and this is just the reverse, which is you must train them on how to use it, because the field of fire in this case was a hotly debated, and I mentioned it earlier. If you look at the short appendix 32, this is just an example. You'll see at 803.45, you'll see actually the leg of the shooter going in at 803.45, and that's short appendix 32. You'll see around, no one around, and by the way, I think the record does not indicate that there were school children in the bus. There were not. So the end result of what we have here is, unfortunately, the district court drew all sorts of factual determinations that were adverse to my client, weighed facts, determined that there was nothing that Captain Noble or the training policy did to put him in a worse risk, which is not correct, because in fact Captain Noble even admitted at page 79 of his deposition in 80 that the danger was increased to Mr. Ross because the shooter entered that store. And to say simply that Kenny Ross was in the wrong place at the wrong time does not do justice to Kenny Ross nor the Constitution, because the Constitution requires that an officer that does respond must respond in a fashion that does not increase or enhance the risk to Kenny Ross. In other words, as Judge Posner said, we cannot throw Kenny Ross into the snake pit. And so to say that he was merely in the wrong place and the wrong time does not do justice to Kenny Ross or the Constitution.
Okay, thanks very much. The case will be taken under advisement.
Thank you, Your Honor.